In this week's programme, we discuss a new book called What Are Universities For? It's been written by Stefan Collini, who is Professor of Intellectual History and English Literature at Cambridge. He argues that universities need to be justified in other than purely economic terms. The most ambitious part of his book is his reassessment of the ideas of John Henry Newman, who in 1852 delivered a set of lectures about establishing a Catholic university in Dublin. Collini is not without humour. He reminds us that Robert Maynard Hutchins once described a university as a series of schools and departments held together by a central heating system. With me, Tom Garvin, Professor Emeritus of Politics at UCD, David McConnell, Professor of Genetics at Trinity College Dublin, and Áine Hyland, former Vice President of UCC and Emeritus Professor of Education, also at UCC. Tom Garvin, what did you make of this book?
I enjoyed it very much. The second half of it actually is a reheat of a whole series of articles he did, I think mainly for the Times Higher Education Supplement. And the first half of it is a take on education. Now, he has various targets. The one that I liked best, if you like, was the urge to quantify that is prevalent among civil servants, some educationalists, and certainly a lot of the people who administer Irish universities over the last decade or thereabouts. The wish to assess people in a way that is quantifiable, particularly academics. So one academic can be declared to be twice as good as another one or half as good as another one, to caricature it only slightly.
Yeah. What he's saying is what's displaced is the act of judgment, isn't that right? That
precisely. It is a way of avoiding thought.
Áine, what did you make of the book?
I liked the first half. I particularly liked his revisiting of Newman's idea of university and his critique of it. I felt it was very, very apt and very good critique. The second half I found not that relevant to Ireland because, as Tom said, it's really revisiting a number of articles, reproducing a number of articles which he had already written in response to various issues that came up in the UK and particularly the Brown Report. Now, I'm not sure my colleagues here would agree with him, but I don't think we have ever gone as far as the Brown Report or indeed gone as far as the UK has gone. So I felt, in a way, the second half of the book wasn't particularly relevant to Ireland, and it would be important that it would not be used as a stick to beat the Irish system with.
David McConnell.
Well, I thought it was a terrific book. I really enjoyed. I hadn't read any of his previous articles. I've read bits and pieces by him in other respects because he's very well known as a, broadly speaking, a politically, well, an intellectual commentator, critic of the. Of the, especially I think of the 19th century. So he's, it's very readable. It's full of nice pieces of humour, of course. I take this point that Tom has made about quantification. He makes a very strong play on that, and he's right in the sense that it's we really have to be terribly, terribly careful that we don't reduce things, everything to numbers. Scientists have a slightly different view of it because, to some extent, quantification suits their method of publication, and we might talk about that a bit more. But it's certainly wrong. Absolutely wrong to rely on quantification as a complete assessment of a person's standing, and the failure to continue to exercise judgment. We have colleagues. I mean, we all have colleagues who are taking time to get off the ground, especially young colleagues. And you have to exercise judgment about them. You have to say, yes, this is going to work, or maybe it isn't going to work. And you need tremendous sympathy and humaneness and so on in a university to be able to make these kinds of assessments. So I was reminded of the quotation from Einstein that not everything that counts can be measured. And not everything that can be measured counts. Mm. And we have got to get away from that. Yeah. I happened to pass by Hodgesicus the other day, and there was Jane Oldmire's new book on the 17th century. It's 2 inches thick. It must be 25 years of work. How would she be assessed up until the day that her book was published? You know, I mean, in fact, she has been well assessed, but that's neither here nor there. People have had faith in her. I remember David Dixon published a lovely book on, I think, something to do with economic history of Munster or something of that sort several years ago. And there was a review of it in the Irish Times by an English historian who said, he was so pleased to see that in the Irish universities a person was allowed to produce a book of that depth and breadth and substance. You see?
Yeah.
So Collini is very good on that. He's one also, of course, we'll probably come to it.
Sure, tomorrow. One of the points he makes is that for the past 100 years and more, every so often, governments insist that, education systems respond to social needs. Can you just clarify one thing for our listeners and for me? The matter of government funding, state funding, here and in the UK and the United States, not to get too complicated about it, but how much government funding are we talking about? Take this country.
I think that's a very, very pertinent point,
yes,
because the proportion of university funding that comes from government in Ireland is huge compared to other countries, particularly compared to the US. I mean, our universities here are funded, about 80% of their costs come from public funds, whereas in the US, even a public university, a state university, usually would have less than 30% of its cost coming from public funding. So that is a very big issue. And I mean, the fact that obviously he who pays the piper calls the tune.
They can, with Irish government, accordingly, can with more reason insist on.
And I think that is one of our problems and one of the things that really has to change. And of course, that became a major issue when fees were abolished. When fees were abolished and the state picked up the tab, universities lost a lot of financial autonomy because so much of their money was now coming directly from the state. And that alone, I think, justifies...
Yeah, the question of funding, Tom Gavin.
There is a tradition of bending the Irish university system or the educational system in general to what are really non-educational purposes. There's nothing particularly new about this kind of attempt to reduce the universities to business models of one kind or another. For a very long time, for example, the university system and the educational system in general was geared to changing the language of the country from English to Irish. And it's only in the last 20 years or so that that has more or less been abandoned. And of course, the university system, as well as the secondary and primary system, was used as a means of instructing people in religious principles. That's something that I have something of a soft spot for personally, but it's not, strictly speaking, educational, is it? So the real purpose of education is actually to produce human beings who can think.
Surely, but if 80% of the funding, as all you're saying, is coming from the, he who pays the piper and so on.
That's true.
But,
David.
Universities are not for the economy. They're not for the government. They're not for the HEA. They're not for businesses or banks or railway companies. They're actually for the students and the staff. And it's very interesting reading some of the HEA documents, recent ones, including this extraordinary one on the landscape of the... The word person or student hardly enters into the document at all. It's entirely focused on how the universities can be aligned with the economy.
Yes.
As if we're producing widgets which will fit into spots
in
the economy.
Is that fairly recent? Did that come in fairly recently? I mean, when?
I think universities have been utilitarian for 500 or 600 years. I mean, that's one of the myths of the history of universities, is that they have not been utilitarian. I mean, what did our early universities do from Bologna onwards? They trained doctors, lawyers, civil servants. I mean, basically, they were utilitarian.
The kind of language that David has been talking about there—that's a fairly recent provenance.
Well,
isn't it?
I think universities may have gone through a good period, better than in the very earliest days when we were training the people to support the king and the church
and so on and so forth.
We have had, I think, a pretty good period. Certainly, I think of the period when I came back in 1970 from the States, and there was a good period.
Good in what sense?
Well, I think there was a focus on trying to strengthen the experience of the students, to provide better facilities for them. There was a beginning of investment. There was the idea of investment in education. That was an astonishing title for a document: investment in education. And it was meant strong all the way along through. It was the person being educated. And I think
There'll be ups and downs in this degree of utilitarianism. I think we're moving into a bad period at the moment. That's what I'm worried about.
One thing he lays out early on is that the formation of future scholars and scientists is intrinsic to the character of university, not to companies that are about making money and so on. That defines the university very much on you, doesn't it?
Yes, and again, as David said, I mean, we have had a very good period, I think, in higher education. Certainly when I actually was a research assistant on the Investment in Education report, I almost know it off by heart. I'm aware of what the situation was then in the 50s and 60s. I mean, something we forget in Ireland, higher education, university education, was not a meritocracy back in Ireland, whereas it was in the UK in those days. It was for those who could afford to pay for it. Yeah. As the nuns said to us as we were coming from secondary school, university education is for the cream of the country, rich and thick. And our nuns, to be honest, didn't have any, the nuns who taught me didn't have any great respect for university education. They felt teacher training was where the really able young people went, and in fact it was, interestingly enough.
Is that true?
Wonderful teachers in primary schools.
So that I think from that point of view, back then, I would look with a somewhat
decade, please.
1950s and 60s, I mean, those who went into areas like medicine and law were those who, 80% of the males who went into the NUI system into law had less than what is now 300 points. I mean, given where we are at the moment, where young people are counting their points, 70% of those who went into medicine at that time had less than what is now 300 points. That's
there were no
minimum
restrictions on entry to
So there were no restrictions
NUI.
At all in those days, but it was a financial ability to go in was what counted. So, I mean, I would be sceptical. The report of the Commission on Higher Education in the mid-60s was scathing about Irish university education, and quite rightly. Since then, I think things have improved dramatically. I wouldn't have the concerns that David has about the future if we can get the money. And that's the big question.
Tell me, when did the obsession with league tables, and that seems to be a global phenomenon, when did that really take off, Tom?
It hit Britain about 25 years ago, and it is echoed here from about, I think, 1995 on, thereabouts. Yeah. And it comes, I think, from the Department of Education looking across its shoulder at Britain. That's my impression.
How meaningful are these tables?
They do mean something. Yeah. But the trouble is they can taken to be as the real thing very quickly. Mm. In other words, there's a kind of monetary illusion operating here.
He says, by the way, they give disproportionate weight to science. Is that true, these league tables, do they, David?
Yeah, I think they may well do. Certainly some of them do, though. The one from Shanghai, for example, measures Nobel Prize winners and things of that sort.
And
there are more Nobel Prizes given in science than there are in... there's only one, I think, in literature, and there's one in economics, and the others are all in science or medicine or whatever. So, yes, there is a overall...
But you think, Tom, there's some merit in them. I mean, they do reflect something. Yeah.
If used cautiously, yes. Citation indexes, for example, do actually give you some idea of who's reading and what and why and where and how. But that discriminates against small and esoteric subjects, for example, where a very, very good paper may be read by just three people who all happen to be in the same subject.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on these league tables?
They have some value, but I would also have reservations about them. For example, I mean, they measure facts, if you like student-staff ratios. Student-staff ratios are a direct outcome of how much investment is in a university. If you're Harvard and you have a private budget, which is greater than all of the money we put into all of higher education in Ireland, if you have it, obviously your class size is going to be much smaller. So the indicators that they use are very often inappropriate, and because they're inappropriate, I would say they're inappropriate, and certainly they militate against Irish universities. So there are issues like that, and I guess that comes back to the quantification. If there is to be quantification, it has to be very sensitive, and it has to, in some sense, try and measure the unmeasurable, and I know that's asking
By the way, a powerful argument, it seems, for the private capitalist system is how well Harvard and Yale and so on do on private money. I mean, standards are still so high.
You're dealing with the university system that has 3,000 colleges, and perhaps 100 of them the best in the world, and another few hundred definitely in the top 500. And they are all competing against each other. They're competing state by state and across an enormous system that's really a kind of world in its own.
Yeah, but there's still a notion of the kind of non-utilitarian kept, the sense of learning for its own sake, even in a system that's, supported by private
culture.
Funding.
Yeah. American culture is very big on
at its highest level. The high levels of American culture are absolutely wonderful.
Mm. Yes.
And we sometimes think of America as being rather bland and uninteresting, and we think of the modern Republican Party and so on, reflecting American culture. But there is a high culture in America which has wonderful music, wonderful literature, wonderful studies in history, Celtic studies,
and
you
it's not
name
sneered
it.
At.
And it's not sneered at, but it's unfortunate, I mean, looked at in a slightly different way, although it is absolutely wonderful, it's hardly appreciated by anybody, percentage-wise, in the United States. We could look at it and wonder at it and think it's absolutely splendid, but it's an elite. We're looking at the elite at the top of a country of 350 million people, still the highest per capita income in the world.
No, my point simply though is that private funding can still produce quality. You know,
but that's
the assumption
it's the top of a huge pyramid.
You need public funding to get it. Sorry, on
yes, I think David's made a very good point there about the small proportion at the top who benefit. But I think the challenge to all of our higher education systems all over the world is how to spread that privilege from a tiny elite to a larger proportion of the population. Yeah. Ireland has tried with some success, and indeed we're one of the more successful countries in terms of extending access. Over 60% of our 18-year-olds
I'm an egalitarian by nature, as most of us are. I still find that sometimes difficult to answer how well the private sector does in that regard in terms of the quality
produced.
Why do we
have this idea that the private sector is unenlightened and the public sector is enlightened? I've found that among some civil servants I have known over the years, a total disregard for the humanities, a total disregard for humane education, if you like, as distinct from applied education, scientific education, and mechanical education, if you like. There is a kind of physiocratism, a kind of belief that if you can't touch it or carry it around with you, it's not worth anything.
Yeah.
You know,
and
it's just words.
And yet, I think one of the very positive things that has happened recently, the new Secretary General of the Department of Education is a graduate of Medieval Irish from Trinity.
Delighted to hear it.
Yeah, and so I think there can be. I was, of course, a civil servant in my early years before the marriage ban, so I am more positively disposed to civil servants.
His criticism of Newman is the kind of god of the great apostle of liberal education. So what do you think of his critique, his discussion of Newman?
I loved his critique because I felt it was realistic. I have to say, as somebody who likes to see things happening rather than see things in writing, I'm an activist rather than a philosopher. I hope I have some elements of philosophy. I was never an admirer of Newman because Newman's... No, I wasn't, because he failed. He failed. He wrote beautifully. I love reading his work. But, of course, the Catholic University was a total failure in that he ran up debts, he didn't have any
but
students.
But that's not the issue, though, is it?
It depends on whether you think is it or is it not the issue.
It's a long time since I've read
Newman. You can run up debts, but really, that in itself doesn't invalidate his ideas.
His idea of university was a young gentleman who had already received a university level education in their secondary schools, who had fluent Latin and Greek, if you like, and weren't taught French because every gentleman knew it already. And they were allowed 3 or 4 years to just go and chat learnedly with each other.
And he would entertain them to dinner in his house of residence. I mean, these were his companions at dinner table.
And the university
age 15 or 16, I think they were very relatively young. But, I mean, Newman, of course, shocks me entirely because he was very suspicious of science.
Yes.
He didn't want to see science
anywhere. And of research.
Absolutely. I mean, although he himself was a very able, obviously tremendously imaginative thinker, he didn't want that in other people. A bit like Augustine. He just didn't want...
I thought one thing he fastens on is that he's critical of Newman, really, for his rhetorical excess in making the case against the utilitarians. He's saying, you know, in other words, he's saying in that sense that Newman is on the side of the angels, Collini agrees with him, but that he's been over the top, Tom, is what he's saying. He's gone over the top.
Well, he's talking about a world that doesn't exist anymore, if it ever existed.
But there is a puzzle about this emphasis. There's a real puzzle about this emphasis on Newman. And I think what Collini is saying is this. Since Newman, nobody has written better in defence of the arts.
Yeah.
And it's a huge criticism of his colleagues since Newman. Mm. With rare exceptions, and Tom, for example, vigorous critic in Ireland, but we don't have very many vigorous critics putting out the views. I mean, the idea that Collini has of the academic republic, the members of the academic intellectual republic taking part as active citizens in contributing to debate.
What he singles out, Collini, that is, as central in Newman, is the idea that there's something wrong with one-sidedness as an outcome in education. He sees that as the heart of Newman. Is it?
Yes. Well, I think for me, if there's one thing I totally believe in, is in terms of the role of the university and the university academic, is the integration of research and teaching and learning. Mm. And I just have a quotation here from Newman. To discover and to teach are two distinct functions. They're also distinct gifts and are not commonly found united in the same person. Mm. I cannot accept that.
And of course the Germans at that time
Newman would argue that the danger in doctoral education is that it made a person one-sided. He was arguing all the time for the broad sort of view that you got, of course, at the primary degree level, Tom.
Well, I think the problem here is that we have segregated the scientists from the arts for a very long time now. Mm. And the arts continue to be interested in sciences, but I sometimes suspect that the sciences are becoming so challenging and so huge that the humanities are being squeezed out.
True, Tom. Do you feel that, David? He's not going to say that.
He was saying that
Humanities
is interested in the sciences, but the sciences, by implication, are not interested in the humanities. Curiously enough, I think we tend to think of it the other way around.
Yeah.
And which I think betrays part of the problem.
I think it is part of the problem.
The science is impenetrable. And what people need to sympathize with scientists. It's very hard for me to penetrate physics.
Yeah.
It's very hard for me to penetrate most of genetics. I'm supposed to profess genetics. I actually am competent within a very narrow, small range of genetics. Outside that, I rely on something which is of enormous importance. It's called authority. Being able to identify the outstanding people and to listen to them and to accept authority.
Which is a perfectly rational posture.
But in the modern world, the notion of authority is a dirty word.
Yeah, but why should it be?
Yeah,
I mean,
what I feel about, you know, science and arts, I agree. We have across centuries failed really to bring the sciences and the arts adequately together, and I think that is a big weakness, particularly on this side of the Atlantic. There is a greater sort of collation, if you like, of arts and sciences in undergraduate education in the United States. But one of the strengths, I take your point, David, about the impenetrability of science, but for somebody like myself, who has an entirely arts humanities background, sadly, I have to say, one of the great strengths that I feel science graduates bring into postgraduate education, particularly in my area, in education, the scientific method, their ability to identify the problem. Mm. And I think that's something that in undergraduate arts education we didn't achieve as well. Yeah. Identify the problem first. Identify the methodology which would help you to come to some answers, not resolve
the
problem.
I mean, he goes along. I mean, he's quite happy to talk about the element of commonality in the humanities and the sciences. Yet he says that the notion of generating new knowledge in the humanities is problematic. In other words, that understanding rather than knowledge is what's going on there, Tom.
I agree.
Well, yeah. Philosophy of science is something that I believe should be taught to everybody.
So do I.
It should be taught at undergraduate level.
I think
in first
be,
year.
Actually, yeah. I think it should be taught for the Leaving Certificate.
Perhaps.
If you're not a if you're not studying the sciences, the hard sciences, there should be another subject on the history and the philosophy of science taken to the Leaving Certificate so that people understand, particularly, the scientific method and, by the way, the nature of authority within science. So you don't have people going off.
The best courses I ever did as an undergraduate were in philosophy of science.
Where did you do those, Tom?
Stuck with me ever since.
Where did you do those? Who did them?
UCD.
Who gave them, as my friend?
Connor Martin, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Carl Popper and all the rest
of terrific.
All the boys. It's wonderful because it actually shows you how you think.
Yes.
A book of this kind, will it be discussed, will it, from your knowledge of it to date, among your colleagues in that, a book of this kind?
Yes, it has already been discussed.
It's jumping off the shelves.
I mean, it's been reviewed in so many places, and indeed my own colleague, Jerry Rickson, reviewed it for the Cork Examiner, and people would not have expected Jerry to be a supporter of a book like this, but in fact he totally would be, and
what,
did.
What is the, is that your feeling, Tom, people responding well to it?
Yes, I think so. I think there's been a lot of confusion in higher education over the last 10, 15 years, and a lot of mistakes have been made, and I think there have been well-meaning mistakes, and I think there has been a learning curve, if you like, but it's a very flat one. There's a lot of rectification going on. I think the university system will survive, but it's going through a very, very rocky phase for the last 10 years.
And in Trinity, they speak of little else, I'm told. Colony, yes,
Well, we certainly are. I mean, when I saw a review of Collini's book, I sent it round to the fellows in college, and I sent round Tom Garvin's article. All the fellows in college received a copy of Tom's article, and they didn't go along with his criticism of the lack of the phone book. But otherwise, I think there was a lot of sympathy for his ideas. I mean, and it's part of a worldwide reaction. If you go to the New York Review of Books or London Review of Books, there are reviews of books about managerialism in universities, failure to focus on the great ideas which have underlain universities.
We've been discussing What Are Universities For? By Stefan Collini, published by Penguin. My thanks to Áine Hyland, Tom Garvin and David McConnell. You can listen to the programme again on our RTE Off the Shelf website at rte.ie. You can also hear it again on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.